last month saw a Congolese city of 1 million people taken over by a group suspected of links to Rwanda. Could this speak to a wider geopolitical strategy? York University professor Justin Potter joins us in this half hour to discuss this. Which big news stories over the last year didn't get as much attention as they deserved? We'll hear from Andy Lee Roth of Project Censored. And, as we reach the end of the Mayan calendar cycle, we'll discuss doomsday scenarios, real and imagined, with Michelle Chosadovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization. On today's program, Congo, Project Censored, and Doomsday 2012. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 20th, 2012. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available for download from the Center's website at globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with some of the major news stories shaping the national and international political landscape. Kerry de Kerkhoff, former High Commissioner to Pakistan and Ambassador to Indonesia and Egypt, argues that Canada should step up its role in resolving the Syrian crisis by arming Syrian rebels and helping to enact a no-fly zone over the country, among other potential measures. In a report released Wednesday by the School of Public Policy, Kerkhoff writes, quote, "To the extent that a political solution is not in the cards and that a direct military intervention is both unlikely and dangerous, providing weapons to the rebels is the only solution to speeding up the end of the conflict," unquote. The author also suggests Canada should help shape the post-civil war Syria that emerges through the following measures: recognize the rebel forces as the country's governing authority, engaging the Arab League more systematically, assisting in the post-Assad reconstruction, including assisting in a process of disarmament and reconciliation, and ensure Canada's actions in Syria bolsters Israel's security. The report can be read online at www.policyschool.ucalgary.ca/publications. And that comes to us from Canada Newswire. A member of the National Opposition Coalition, recognized by the U.S. and other allies as Syria's viable governing alternative, has said that Russian civilians in the conflict-ridden country are considered legitimate military targets. To quote Haitham al-Maleh, a member of the National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Forces, quote, "Russia, like Iran, supports the Assad regime with weapons and ammunition, as well as in the political arena, so the citizens of these countries are legitimate targets for militants in Syria," unquote. This follows an announcement by a group of gunmen who kidnapped a Ukrainian journalist near the city of Homs in early October that Russians, Ukrainians, and Iranians in Syrian territory would all be targeted. The Free Syrian Army kidnapped 48 Iranian nationals in early August and threatened to kill them if demands for the release by President Assad of rebel prisoners were not met. And that comes to us from Russia Today. Three Russian warships and two support ships are being sent to join Russian naval forces in the Mediterranean, according to an announcement by the Russian Defense Ministry Tuesday. The Navy statement explains their mission includes exercises in air defense and anti-ship warfare and anti-submarine warfare. A Navy source told the Interfax news agency that the deployment was planned as a contingency to evacuate Syria in the event Damascus loses more territory to rebel fighters. Moscow denies the move reflects a change in their stance regarding the Syrian conflict. And that also comes to us from Russia Today. On November 20th, while the world's attention was focused on the conflict in Gaza, a Congolese rebel group by the name of M23 took over the city of Goma in the easternmost province of North Kivu. After successfully repelling a counterattack by the Democratic Republic of Congo's military, the M23 rebels agreed to withdraw from Goma earlier this month. Given the mineral wealth of the North Kivu region and accusations of M23 being a proxy for Rwanda, is there a larger geostrategy in play here? To help us explore this question, we spoke with Justin Potter. Justin Potter is an associate professor of environmental studies at York University, a writer and blogger, and the author of the recent book Haiti's New Dictatorship, The Coup, the Earthquake, and the UN Occupation. Justin Potter has been to the Democratic Republic of Congo in the city of Bukavu twice in the last 3 years. Justin Potter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Could you help maybe provide us with a little bit of background of this conflict? I know that you've been to Bukavu, and you've also in the DRC, and you have written a couple of blogs about it. Could you maybe, provide us some of that historical context for us, please? For example, the M23 itself, what exactly is the evidence that this is a Rwandan-backed rebel group?
Okay, a couple of points first. Before we get into the history, I think we should talk a little bit about the geography. So where I spent time was in Bukavu, which is in South Kivu, which is a province that, of course, borders North Kivu. Both of the Kivus are on the border with Rwanda. And the city of Bukavu has a kind of a sister city in Rwanda called Cyangugu. The city of Goma has a kind of a sister city in Rwanda called Gisenyi. So in both of these cases, you could, other than the border control, simply walk from Gisenyi in Rwanda to Goma in Congo. You could walk from Cyangugu in Rwanda to Bukavu in the Congo. So this is the context in which these conflicts are happening. So nobody in the region, absolutely nobody who understands the geography or who lives there, has the slightest doubt that M23 is from Rwanda. When they're negotiating, there are these long, drawn-out negotiations in Kampala now between M23 and the Congolese government, and one of the disputes is that how far M23 is supposed to withdraw from Goma. So they withdrew as part of this agreement, the ceasefire agreement with the government, and they want to count their withdrawal from the Rwandan border, and the Congolese government wants to count it from Goma. So Rwanda is part of any serious conversation. In fact, its role has been less hidden in this latest round of conflict than it has in the past, I think. I think a lot of, the New York Times or the Washington Post, they're all writing about Rwanda's role. They've all named Rwanda since November. Now, what is the evidence? There's several sources of evidence. One of them is all of them are documented extensively in the reports by the United Nations panel of experts on Rwandan involvement in the Congo. The UN has published a bunch of there was a report that was leaked to the media in October of 2012, but they've published a letter that came out pretty recently, like a 16-page letter with lots of details. There's a testimony by Steve Hage, the head of the experts, who's also testified in front of the U.S. Senate, I believe. So there's lots of sources, but in terms of like what a simple evidence would look like, one is, of course, the geography, as I've explained, and the other is the personnel. So if you look at the commanders, one of the commanders of M23 is this guy Bosco Ntaganda. He's Rwandan. He was with the RPF when they invaded Rwanda, during the Civil War and the Rwandan genocide in the 90s. Sultani Makenga, I believe is his name, also of, Rwandan RPF origin. So they say that they're Congolese Tutsis, but that's not really their military and organizational and professional background. Wherever they were born, they have been part of the Rwandan military and the Rwandan army. And the evidence found by the United Nations links them back to James Kabarebe, who was the Rwandan head of the Rwandan military today. And Kabarebe has been involved in successive invasions of the Congo since 96, 98, and so on. After 98, the Rwandans stayed in the Kivus, and they found various local names for the militias and the armed groups that they set up. The RCD was one of them, the CNDP was one of them, and now the M23 is one of them. So it's not some kind of difficult investigative project to figure out who they are and what they're about. It seems like the harder thing is of course getting people with influence in the region, like the United States and Canada and Britain, to actually pay attention and apply a certain degree of historical memory to the situation.
So, what about the international community then, in terms of the support? I mean, both the Democratic Republic of Congo on the one side, you've got Rwanda on the other, and where are you seeing the major international players positioning themselves here?
Well, the major international players in that part of the world, the United States is the big player, but other European countries have some say, and a lot of the northern European countries have been paying attention to the United Nations reports, and they've been cutting aid to Rwanda, and they've been publicly saying that Rwanda should stop this, and that's played a big role. I think that's the reason M23 are negotiating right now instead of continuing this kind of murderous march across the Congo. A guy from Friends of the Congo, Maurice Carney, he was on the radio. He was on a radio program a few weeks ago, maybe a week and a half ago, and he said something like, M23 will go as far as they're allowed to go by the United States. And I think that's right. I think, the U.S. has felt some pressure from Europe and from the UN panel to tell Rwanda that they've got to negotiate. They've got to try to accomplish their goals with a less destructive iron fist kind of approach. And there are that is kind of where I think they're headed now. They're headed towards trying to win at the negotiating table what they were forced to, stop doing on the battlefield, which is they're trying to make arguments that the Kivus specifically should be decentralized and probably ultimately partitioned into, a set of countries, Eastern Congo or something like that, that would then be easier for Rwanda to dominate. And this is, this is something that at the negotiating table in Uganda, M23 is talking about this in terms of federalism and federalist proposals. But if you look in the Ugandan newspaper, the Daily Monitor or the New York Times, I've written about these There are these op-eds where they're talking about how maybe in order to save Congo, we need to let it fall apart. Maybe Rwanda and Uganda, instead of being condemned, maybe they should be celebrated for ushering in a new Africa's new next country. And, you know, they're offering Sudan, South Sudan, as an example. And this is a terrible example because South Sudan had been fighting for independence since 1950, I mean, basically since Sudan became an independent country, and they won their independence through there was a peace process that agreed to a referendum, and the referendum, people voted overwhelmingly for independence. And so the idea that this is comparable to the Kivus, which have been occupied by Rwanda for 15 years, that have been plundered and pillaged and raped by these foreign powers. And, there's absolutely no comparison at all.
This is the comes down to, at least officially, this idea of because the Democratic Republic of Congo is largely underdeveloped, at least as far as international entities are concerned. And here you have these robust forces in Rwanda and Uganda that might be better suited to developing it, or something along those lines. Or?
No, it's not a developmentalist argument, really, because Rwanda and Uganda are also not exactly developmental success stories. That Rwanda, they talk about Rwanda as a success story, and Rwanda's recovered from an absolute, obviously in terms of where they started, after the genocide, they've recovered a lot since the genocide, which is to their credit, but they've done so using, plundered Congolese minerals, and they're still as very dependent on foreign aid, and their most developed area is their military. Uganda has an insurgency in the north that they still haven't, been able to. They are taking an iron fist approach. There's longstanding grievances with minority communities. They're also not a developmental showcase to the world. So it's not a developmental argument. The Europeans know this, the donor countries know this, that the argument is more crass than that. The argument is more that the Congo can't control its vast territory, and so the Rwandans and Ugandans have the military capacity to take what they want, and who's going to stop them?
Now, the Eastern Congo, as opposed to the rest of Congo, has resources that are coveted by the West, and I suppose China and other countries as well, right?
Well, yeah. Although it's not just the East. So the Kivus have gold and coltan and copper and tin, but Katanga, which is west of the Kivus, has lots of copper. Katanga is very famous from Congolese history because it was Katanga that did a secession in the 1960s when the Belgians wanted to make sure they could keep their control of Congolese resources after independence. So there was Katanga and Kasai, which also have significant resources. Kasai has diamonds. They did these separations. The Belgians supported them. There were various arguments for partition. This was the Congo crisis of the 1960s. So, in a way, they talk a lot about South Sudan being the parallel, but that's partly because people have very short memories. In fact, a much better parallel for what's going on today is the Congo crisis of the 1960s, in which a small power, Belgium, for its own reasons and for its own benefit, encouraged the secession of the Congo in order to better control a smaller part of the Congo and prevent a stronger centralized Congolese state from emerging.
So partitioning is essentially just a mechanism by which larger imperial powers can maintain control?
Yeah, and there's absolutely no... And it's kind of like a it's not a last resort, but it's definitely more of a contingency plan. They'd always rather control the whole country, but if they can't, then they're willing to settle for creating instability through claims for separation. So with Katanga's secession, it was brought up, it was used tactically until Lumumba was killed, and then it was taken off the table, and the United Nations then crushed the secession that they had basically argued while Lumumba was alive that they couldn't do anything about. Mm-hmm. And similarly, it's an entirely tactical kind of consideration now. Nobody in the Kivus wants to secede. There's no Kivu nationalism. There's absolutely no interest in that in the Kivus. Everybody sees themselves as Congolese. There's interest in federalism, but federalism is a whole separate proposal than what the M23 is talking about now.
My impression, though, is like when you look at other areas where there's like partitioning or attempts at partitioning, there's usually some ethnographic line on like whether it's a religion or different tribes or whatever. But you don't see that coming into play at Congo at all.
Well, the claim is no. You do, because the claim of the M23 is that they're Congolese Tutsis fighting for their rights and fighting to prevent an additional genocide of Tutsis in the Congo. So their claim is very specifically Congolese Tutsi, and one of the problems is, of course, that not all Congolese Tutsi are interested in M23 or their claims. Like, a lot of Congolese Tutsi see themselves as Congolese and are also not interested in this kind of Rwandan game that's being played out there. So remember, the Congo is an incredibly diverse country. There's many, many language groups, many, many ethnicities. It's geographically vast. It's 2 million square kilometers. It's 60 some million people. In the east, in the Kivus, there's Bashi, there's Banyamulenge, there's lots of different ethnicities even there. But then, you go further west and you get Baluba, Lua, you get in Ituri, there's lots and lots of ethnic diversity. So one of the upshots of this is you can always find some division that can be exploited from a colonial perspective, especially in Congo, where there's been deliberate, systematic attempts to destroy any kind of nation-building project since the 50s and 60s when it became an issue.
So going into 2013, do you have any thoughts about how this situation is likely going to play out?
Well, I don't think there's any basis for a sustainable peace right now. The Rwandans want control of the Kivus. The Congolese state wants to assert its authority over its territory. And that's going to be a dispute, and how that plays out depends a lot on what the United States, what United States allies are going to allow the Rwandans to do. And I think, in a way, we saw some limits put on Rwanda recently, but that's caused more of a change in strategy than a change in objective. And as long as those objectives are opposed in that way, I think we're going to see the same kinds of patterns that we've seen over the past 15 years. There's going to be violence, there's going to be people displaced, there's going to be sporadic fighting, there's going to be a totally ineffective United Nations mission, and there's going to be these negotiations. And, maybe the M23 will have a new name in a couple of years, but it'll basically be the same kind of pattern.
Okay. Well, Justin Potter, thank you very much for your analysis of this whole situation.
Thanks.
And Justin Potter is an associate professor of environmental studies at York University. He has traveled to the Congo, to the town of Bukavu, on two occasions since 2009.
drown out the faintest hint of commie faggot heretics. The nail that sticks up gets hammered down. The master's finest, his finest tools have found. Slack-jawed, placid, amidst the cacophony of screaming billboards and Disney-fied history. Sometimes the ties that bind us are strange. No justice shines upon the cemetery plots marked Hampton Weaver anime. Where federal bureaus and fraternal orders have cast their shadows, permanent features built into these borders. But under cover of the customary gap we find between history and truth found in fathers, back with the rockets blinding red glare, the bombs bursting in air. One nation indivisible. The truth is, when backcountry learned of ratification, the people had a coffin painted black, solemnly borne in funeral procession, and buried it deep in the earth as an emblem of the disillusion, internment of their republic liberty. And someday, somewhere, today's empires, tomorrow's ashes.
That was Today's Empires, Tomorrow's Ashes by Propagandhi, as performed by the Magnificent Sevens. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partner campus community radio stations across the country. We are also podcast at the site for the Center for Research on Globalization at globalresearch.ca.
Project Censored has just released Censored 2013, and this is the top 25 most censored stories from the year 2011 to 2012. Joining me by phone is Andy Lee Roth. He is the associate director of Project Censored, and he was the one of the editors of this year's Censored 2013. So how are you doing there, Andy?
Fine, thanks, Michael. It's a pleasure to join you on the air.
Okay, so do you, first of all, in compiling this year's top 25, do you want to maybe just help our listeners understand the methodology? How do you, you know, what benchmarks have to be met in order to qualify as being the top 25 most censored stories?
Right. It's actually a year-long process by which we're identifying, vetting, and ultimately ranking stories. And it's a process that involves hundreds of people from across the United States, and in some cases even around the world. The process is already underway for the Censored 2014 book. We monitor independent media, some 800 or so websites and blogs on the internet, another 200 or so print sources. And initially, it's students in Project Censored-affiliated classes at colleges and universities across the United States and North America, and indeed around the world. They bring forward stories, and initially they're vetting those stories for the credibility of the sources, the quality of the reporting overall, and then also checking on the timeliness and import of the story, and finally, for whether or not the corporate media have covered the story at all or in a complete way. And those stories, once they pass an initial round of vetting, appear on the Project Censored website as what we call validated news stories or validated independent news stories bins. From there, the stories undergo further evaluation, especially for whether there has been subsequent corporate media coverage. And eventually, in the spring of each year, we go from a list of approximately 300 or so candidate stories through a voting process among all the affiliate campuses down to about 25 stories. Those stories ultimately then go to an international panel of judges who put the stories in a rank order from 1 to 25.
Okay.
So there are no fewer than 5 stages where any particular story that we're considering undergoes a kind of vetting for the quality of the story, the significance of the story, whether there's corporate coverage. And in the introduction to the book, the director of Project Censored, Mickey Huff, and I write that by the time a story appears in Censored, it's undergone 5 distinct rounds of review and evaluation. The stories that Project Censored brings forward may be socially and politically controversial, sometimes even psychologically challenging, but we're confident that each story we bring forward is the result of serious journalistic effort. So it's really it's actually a central part of Project Censored's mission, which is teaching the public, but also students in particular, media literacy and critical thinking skills. So
It sounds
a very serious process for us to bring forward a story and say, this is so important that you ought to know about it.
Okay, and there does seem to be a very impressive, as every year, a very impressive list of stories, quite surprising in many cases. I noticed, though, that you've aggregated them along what are called news clusters. Do you want to talk about those 5 clusters that you've identified?
Yeah, this was an innovation of Mickey Huff, the Project Censored's most recent and current director, arising out of a kind of a dissatisfaction at some level with the listing process or the listing form, where it's really hard to say that a story that's number 24 is less important than the story that's number 3. And the clusters are an attempt to create a bigger picture and to look at the interconnections between particular news stories. So, for instance, we have a whole censored news cluster on the police state and civil liberties that ties together a handful of stories that share that theme in common. And this is something where, again, we're trying to, as an independent journal media organization ourselves, we're trying to do something that we often critique the corporate media for failing to do, which is connecting the dots between stories to get a what are the underlying structures, what are the overarching themes. And so the news clusters on topics like the environment and health, the human costs of war and violence, women and gender, race and ethnicity, economics, these are ways of showing connections and continuity across particular news stories.
Okay. Now, let's see, we've got the police state and civil liberties, from Bankster bailout to blessed unrest. Environmental and health, human cost of war and violence, and women and gender, race and ethnicity. Maybe we could just sort of look at a sample from each of those different clusters. So for under police, state, and civil liberties, I noticed one here, FBI agents responsible for majority of terrorist plots in the United States? That's kind of
This is our number. This is our number 4 story, and indeed one of the key stories in that police state and civil liberties cluster. This is a story that was brought forward as a collaborative effort between reporters at Mother Jones Magazine, a long-standing investigative outlet, and the investigative journalism program at the University of California, Berkeley. And working together, folks at Mother Jones and Berkeley identified that the FBI has a network of nearly 15,000 spies, moles, and informants whose job it is to infiltrate various communities within the United States, ostensibly to uncover terrorist plots. But what the report that we brought forward as our number four story indicates is that in many cases, those 15,000 spies, moles, informants are actually encouraging and then assisting the people in those communities in committing the very crimes that the people are then busted for. So it's a kind of setup operation, and it appears to be motivated by a desire on the FBI's part to show that they are playing an effective role in the battle against terrorism on the home front. In this case, what's, I think, a key element of this story is this only works as a kind of PR strategy if the corporate media cooperate and basically take the government officials who speak on behalf of the program as the sole sources on the program's efficacy. What's not covered in the corporate media, but what can be documented in independent media coverage, is that most of these cases, when they go to court, the judge throws them out for lack of merit. They don't even go to trial. So the charges against the people are so trumped up that judges typically deem them not worthy of convening a trial to evaluate. So it's again part of a larger picture of ways in which civil liberties are being violated, ostensibly for the sake of national security, but often in ways that seem to be designed more to keep us feeling fearful and dependent rather than autonomous and free.
Now, I noticed another news cluster is women and gender, race and ethnicity. I guess one that kind of pops out to my mind is sexual violence against women soldiers on the rise and under wraps.
Yeah, this one is the story that is some ways the focal point for this is the 2005 death of a U.S. Army private, Lavina Johnson, that was officially ruled suicide by the Department of Defense, but in fact is sort of exemplary of the sexual violence that female soldiers in the U.S. Armed Forces encounter on a daily basis in the course of serving their country. In Johnson's case, her autopsy revealed wounds that were inconsistent with the suicide verdict, things including chemical burns that some people involved in the investigation believe were intended to destroy DNA that would have been evidence that would have been indicative of rape before her death. She's one of at least 20 female soldiers who have died under similarly suspicious circumstances in the past year or so. In 2010, the Department of Defense estimated that there were over 3,100 total reports of sexual assault in the military, but they estimate that represents only about 13.5% of the actual assaults because many of the cases are never reported, never filed. Suggesting that a more accurate figure, annual figure for rape and sexual assault in the military would be close to 19,000 cases per year. So this is a story that has not gotten and is not getting the attention it deserves in the corporate media, at a time when in the United States the discourse is so much around supporting our troops, it's a story that ought to be more widely known.
Yeah, now there's 25 stories here, and it's like, unfortunately, we don't have time to go through them all, but I mean, notice you also have Fukushima nuclear disasters worse than anticipated. That would be the environment and health one, and that's one that I had understood as being a pretty significant story. I don't know if you wanted to talk about that one or if there are any others that you think deserve some attention.
That Fukushima story is actually itself a cluster of several stories, and I'll just mention briefly that one dimension of the way in which the Fukushima disaster is worse than anticipated is that here in the United States, the Environmental Protection Agency's Radiation Detection Network, RADNET as it's known, actually was down during the crucial time in which fallout of Fukushima would have been making its way across the Pacific and to North America. And during the time that the federal government RADNET monitoring system was down, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission arranged for a private radiation monitoring group to do the monitoring. So at a time when we really desperately needed rigorous testing of food, water, and air throughout the U.S., the official monitoring system was down in favor of one that is basically a nuclear industry provided monitoring group. And that's a very disturbing trend when we're thinking about, for instance, the autonomy of science from business interests and so forth and so on.
Okay, so a very impressive list of stories, very shocking in a lot of cases. How does this selection compare with previous years?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'll use that as an occasion to let listeners know that all of the summaries of the top 25 stories for this year, as well as the archives of previous year's top 25 lists, are all available at the Project Censored website, which is projectcensored.org. In answer to the question, the news clusters in some ways indicate some of the continuity. This isn't the first year that we've had a news cluster on the human costs of war and violence. And so the specifics of the stories occupying that cluster this year are different than they were in 2012. But there is certainly continuity in that area. Our number two story out of the environmental cluster this year is on the fragility of the fragile character of the world's oceans, and that echoes stories that we have covered in previous years as well. So in each case, we have new and developing data and news, but the broad themes are ones often of, unfortunately, of continuity, that the we are still treating the ocean as if it's infinite and inexhaustible when it's not.
So, Censored 2013, the top 25 censored stories from 2011 to 12, is available now. And so you can go to the website projectcensored.org to order a copy and to look at the archives, correct?
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Okay, well, so thanks a lot to Andy Lee Roth for joining us. Andy Lee Roth is the Associate Director of the Project Censored, as well as the one of the editors who put together this Censored 2013. December 21st, 2012 marks the end of the long count in the Mayan calendar system, not the end of the world. So say Mayan scholars, Mayan priests, and even much of the mainstream media. Yet the meme seems to persist as the apocalyptic date approaches. Nevertheless, there is cause for concern about an actual doomsday scenario playing itself out in the near future with world-ending consequences. To discuss these scenarios, we have on the line Michel Chosadovsky, head of the Center for Research on Globalization. He's recently authored an article on his site about this subject. So thank you for joining us, Michel Chosadovsky.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be on the program. Essentially, what we are dealing with is a campaign by the mainstream media to obfuscate the real social and economic crisis. In other words, the emphasis is on various doomsdays as well as catastrophes, rather than on the fact that at this stage, the United States and its allies are waging a military adventure at the global level with potentially devastating consequences. We can see it in the Middle East as it unfolds. But at the same time, this long war is coupled with the most serious economic crisis in world history, which is marked by the collapse of productive systems, the plummeting of the standard of living worldwide, a worldwide process of impoverishment, which is not the result of a scarcity of resources. It's the result of manipulation. It's the result of policy. So that while people have their eyes riveted on the end of the world in the Mayan calendar, another doomsday is unfolding. I don't wish to say that this is an end of the world scenario, but what I can say is that preemptive war using nuclear weapons does, in a real sense, threaten the future of humanity. Applying austerity measures systematically in country after country as a solution to the crisis leads to the cause, actually, of the crisis, namely further collapse, so that the solution is the cause. We're at a very dangerous crossroads in our history, and public opinion doesn't realize it. They don't realize that there's a war without borders, which is unfolding as part of a Pentagon agenda. They don't realize that the military-industrial complex is essentially acquiring all the revenues from the state treasury to finance endless wars. That weapons, real weapons of mass destruction, have been developed by the major powers, including the United States, which again threaten the future of humanity.
Now,
not to mention unmanned drones attacking civilians, the repeal of civil liberties, the unfolding police state, and so on.
Okay, Dr. Chostovsky, if I could just you mentioned that the continuing meme about this doomsday scenario with the Mayan calendar as being sort of a distraction from these actual concerns. I mean, is a significant difference there that with the Mayan calendar, you're talking about something that's sort of more out of the hands of ordinary people or of human beings, as opposed to these scenarios which are all man-made?
Well, precisely. I mean, first of all, what the Mayan prophecy says is that this is the end of a calendar cycle, so to speak, and a new calendar emerges. They never talk about end of the world. They talk about a renewal, a rebirth, so that there's an underlying misinterpretation. It's not to say that any mainstream media will actually deny this, but the fact that this is top of the news, plastered on the tabloids, is a distraction. And what I'm saying is we have a real crisis, which is man-made, which is threatening life on this planet, which is threatening the environment, which is leading to countless deaths of civilians in the U.S.-led wars around the world, not to mention the collapse of the whole era of achievement, particularly in Western society, what we call the welfare state. And in other words, not only are we repealing all these achievements, but at the same time, we are incapable of analyzing and understanding what is going on because the media doesn't address these issues.
And of course, with the whole idea of a date when the world ends, we're not just talking about something that's going to happen. It is happening now.
Absolutely. Now, the thing is, if we want to look at threats to the future of humanity, let's say doomsday scenarios, we must understand that whatever end of the world might occur, when it's man-made, it's a gradual process. It's a gradual process of decay, of destruction. It's reversible, okay? It's reversible because people can act, with one another in social movements across the land in reversing this trend. But there is a trend, okay? There is a trend, and that trend has been ongoing maybe since the early 1980s. It's the trend of global impoverishment. It's the dismantling of public institutions, health and education. It's the development of very advanced weapon systems in the military sphere. It's, again, endless wars. We talk about the post-war era as the era extending from 1945 onwards, the post-World War II era. But look at all the wars that have taken place during that period. The Korean War in the 1950s, North Korea, 30% of the North Korean population was killed during that war. Now, do people know that? Do they know that General Curtis LeMay, who was the U.S. commander there, actually acknowledged this in a public statement? And then, of course, North Korea is demonized as a threat to global security. Do they know that some 4 to 5 million people died in the wars, the civil wars in the Congo, which were essentially resource wars? Do they know that in the Sudan there were 4 or 5 million people killed and impoverished? None of these wars, which are, in a sense, they are doomsday for the people who are living them, right? It's the end of the world when your life is shattered, when you lose your land, when you go bankrupt. 250,000 Indian farmers have committed suicide because of genetically modified seeds which have penetrated into the agricultural system, and they're bankrupt because they can't reproduce their seeds. All of this points to an end of the world situation for the peoples who are living these realities, and that is what I emphasize in my article. It's the dramatic nature of the world order in which we're living. I don't wish to paint a deterministic perspective on this, because I believe that through social action, these trends can be reversed. But it does require, foremost, that these realities be understood. And for these realities to be understood, we have to start dismantling this media propaganda apparatus, namely media disinformation, which day after day echo essentially falsehoods regarding the war, falsehoods regarding the economy, and where the plight of humanity is either trivialized or not mentioned.
Now, the whole idea of dismantling that propaganda system, that's sort of part of the mandate of this program and of your own website. But I'm wondering, having dismantle that propaganda system, how do you see the tide being reversed? Are we talking about several campaigns or maybe one kind of core campaign?
Reality is changed as a result of people acting concurrently, collectively, together to change the order of things, both at the political, economic level. How will that occur? That's part of history and our future history. But if I had to say, and it's not necessarily things which will be achieved from one day to the next. In the financial arena, I would say we have to freeze financial manipulation, speculative operations, derivatives. Already that is a major achievement. There are many things that could be done, but ultimately we also have to understand that our society is based on power structures. People who own property, who are, well, essentially they also own the banks, the financial institutions, the oil companies, the weapons factories, and so on, so that power structure has to be targeted, inevitably. Okay, the oil companies, the biotech conglomerates, Monsanto, the big media companies, that is the power structure behind the system. And it has to be targeted. It has to be dismantled in some form or another. But I say that a precondition for that to occur is that people actually understand what's going on, okay? And that they refuse this Orwellian New World Order, which is based on twisted realities. And let me be more specific. Essentially, people are led to believe that war is a peacemaking operation, okay? Humanitarian warfare. They are also led to believe that we need to repeal civil liberties to uphold democracy. So it's the police state is an instrument of democracy. That's what's being proposed. They believe that austerity means prosperity, that austerity measures are used to create prosperity. They believe that wealth accumulation is an indicator of progress and development. And this, of course, is unfolding as we speak, that actually killing and torturing alleged terrorists is required to ensure national security. There are a whole series of concepts which are outright fabrications and which then are instilled in the mindset of millions of people. And as long as that is the case, we cannot initiate that kind of mass movement. We have to reverse that inquisitorial order which affects people's the way people think, their consciousness and so on, their ability to act. And as long as people do not recognize and understand the world in which they live, we will not be able to implement meaningful social action at the grassroots level. And that's why that's why independent media is so important.
Okay, well, Shel Chostovsky, I really appreciate those insights and certainly look forward to speaking to you again in the new year. We'll do what we can to, I guess, reveal the truth to the best of our ability and hopefully help to dismantle that propaganda apparatus, as no doubt will your website. So thank you very much, Michelle Chostovsky, for sharing these views with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on the program. Our website is at globalresearch.ca, and best wishes to everybody for the holiday season.
Yes, and a Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye for now.
And that was Professor Michelle Chostovsky, who's the head of the Center for Research on Globalization, and he spoke to us from Montreal.
The Global Research News Hour is broadcast every Thursday at 10 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM and on our partner stations across the country. You can download our podcasts from the Center for Research on Globalization's website at globalresearch.ca. I am host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.